No, still morning.
Morning.
Getting close.
Feels like afternoon.
I want to, on behalf of the court, welcome students who are here today. We have students from Riverview Middle School. Would those students please stand? And welcome to you all. You may be seated. And we have students from Brookfield East High School. Would those students please stand? And welcome to you all. You may be seated. The students are here with our Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. The students attend an oral argument. They've been given materials about the case and may have studied this case in class. And we'll meet with a justice of the court after this second oral argument. We also have another special guest with us today, Judge Tomohiro Nagashima, who is a judge of the first instance in Tokyo, Japan. Thank you for attending. He was here in the prior argument, too. Thank you for being here. And the judge hopes to visit with the University of Wisconsin Law School's East Asian Legal Studies Center later today or tomorrow. We've met all of you. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I will be meeting with you after this case is completed. On my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Patience Rogensack. With these introductions made, we will call our second and last case for today, 02-2555 CR, State v. John Allen. And arguing for John Allen is Michael, is it Bax? Backus. And then arguing for the state will be Assistant Attorney General Christopher G. Wren, and then Mr. Backus will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Okay, counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Backus. I'm officed out of Milwaukee, and I represent John Allen in this matter before the court. John Allen is currently housed at Columbia Correctional. Your Honors, the issue that this case brings before the court is fundamental with respect to concerns as to wrongful conviction and the application, I believe, of the concerns addressed in Strickland and Mockner and the desire, it sort of balances in the seeking to find a balancing point or the fulcrum with respect to Bentley and other cases that have been decided with respect to what level of showing must be made by a party before they're entitled to a hearing with respect to the effectiveness of their counsel and the manner in which their defense was handled. Fundamental to this case as well is what I consider differentiating and which must be considered is the record that reflects clearly that Mr. Allen and counsel were at odds and a record was being developed, a part of which, for example, clearly indicated that in a case where Mr. Allen was facing many years in prison, and in fact is sentenced to 50 years in prison, did not receive his discovery from his attorney until the morning of trial. That combined with the further record that was being made at that point indicated not only a fundamental disagreement with respect to serious issues, but also, in my view of things, raised certain red flags that should somehow trigger a different application of Bentley than one finds in the withdrawal of a plea. As in the Bentley case, where a person in a colloquy with a judge crosses the line and says, I'm pleading guilty because I'm guilty, or I am in fact pleading guilty, and then wants to come back, that certainly, that very fact of that plea places, I would respectfully submit, that case in a different category. The Saunders case sort of rides in the middle in that there was a trial there, but in reviewing that case, I found nothing which indicated that there was any record made or any problems or red flags, if you will, flying prior to the verdict. And then the party coming forward and saying that they weren't given a fair trial. And I,
Counsel, can I ask you a question just pertaining to the, as I look at this, there seems to be, there's a disagreement between your client and his former counsel as far as how he conducted himself and how this trial was prosecuted. Now, I just want to get one example. There was the letter example, which was in your brief, that there was a certain letter that was written by a Mr. Bolden, purportedly writing a letter to the authorities. And as I understand this, the complaint is that your client indicated that the counsel never investigated this. But when I read the, I didn't read the whole record, but I read your brief and the information that was provided there, that there really wasn't any showing that this letter actually existed. In other words, Mr. Bolden, who was a witness, he testified that there was no letter, that he had written no letter, and there was no showing that any letter actually existed. Now, are you saying, just enlighten me as far as the deficient performance on part of the, you know, former counsel as far as that issue is concerned?
Well, very much so. And I think it relates to the whole package, so to speak. But the counsel had to waive his opening and, in his case in chief, called, besides the defendant, only Mr. Bolden and asked him, quite frankly, right out of the blocks about this letter, which the man denied. Now, there was no motion in limine with respect to that letter. There was no discovery with respect to that letter. And it left counsel in front of the jury with his answer. And quite frankly, that by itself can happen. We see that often. It was surely a mistake, but it's indicative of the concern I have with respect to this case, which is a part of this is when a counsel says, well, I've investigated everything, and that's the record. And right before trial, he's saying, I checked all this out, and Mr. Allen, in his own way, says, that's a lie, you know, and the court lets it sit there. And that combined with, again, as well, no investigation as to the concerns of Mr. Allen about these investigations.
What evidence was there that this letter ever existed? Is it just a bald-faced statement by the defendant that there was a letter?
There, Your Honor, was an indication in the discovery of a letter. But it was never verified, and there is certainly the possibility that the letter never existed, but was a mistake, that in fact the letter makes reference to a phone call. Certainly Mr. Bolden did call the sensitive crime unit.
And he said he did. He did, in his testimony, he said he had called. I believe that was part of the record that I did read, but I was just referring to the statement and then the response of the counsel and then the assertion by your client that this was, you know, inefficient or ineffective assistance of counsel under Strickland.
That's true, Your Honor. However, it's one of the series of things that was being put forward. And again, I asked the court to consider the pressure of the situation. As a trial lawyer, I can assure you, when a defendant is in the situation Mr. Allen is in, to try to verbalize and to make these points is not something that is easy. And certainly he's making that effort. And what concerns me, again, is the record seems to show that. It's showing there's a problem here. And it's substantiated by counsel himself. I would inform the court, as a practitioner in Milwaukee, that when a court is a matter scheduled for trial at 10 o'clock, that the bullpen behind the court is loaded with perhaps another 5 to 10 in some cases, but at least a handful of other parties who are entering pleas or doing scheduling conferences. And so when counsel says, well, you got your discovery this morning, what that means is he slid it through the bars of a holding cell with a bunch of other people in there and says, now you can read it. And I, quite frankly, if I were the judge, as I see it, I just when that statement was made by the counsel, it would have thrown up such a concern that I would have said, wait a minute, are you telling me that with a case of this kind, we're talking about not some burglary where there's a fingerprint or something, we're talking about an allegation with multiple victims of a very serious nature, that now you're going to be studying these reports for the first time? That would have warranted, in my view, with all respect, I think, a consideration for adjourning the trial and addressing that issue. But it goes beyond that, and the letter is part of it, and the concerns that there were statements made, previous accusations made. Counsel was reaching out at that point with respect to the prior conviction of Mr. Bolin, although that was his view of it, and that was a part of the record. Certainly I can understand that relevance may have very well decided against that.
Do I understand that you're claiming that Bentley was misapplied here and that there should have been a Mockner hearing?
That's my argument, Your Honor.
Right. Can you tell us why specifically? What prong or prongs of Bentley were ignored in this situation?
Well, I would argue both. And first of all, the red flags, as I've described it, I think apply to the first prong. And whether there's some ground here to have a Mockner hearing. I mean, is there something here other than a bald accusation, unsupported? Or as in Bentley itself, the fact he's just claiming, well, I didn't know the pro-eligibility date correctly, you know, which really doesn't affect the liability portion. The prejudice, the lack of discretion, in my view, was when the judge said, listen, even if this stuff, this letter, even if these things would have generated something, it wouldn't have changed anything. The jury decided to believe the accuser, and they chose to believe that, and therefore there was no harm, and that's in the judge's ruling. He's saying this wouldn't have mattered. Well, I respectfully think that was a lack of discretion, because in this type of a case, especially, where these things are going on and you're facing a young accuser, and when a person is facing a child accuser, you have to, if you're going to have a fair hearing, in my view, consider all the forces that are around that accusation or could contribute to that accusation or could contribute knowledge to that accusation, as this court has decided many times in this type of a case.
Counselor, I kind of like you to focus on the specifics that were made in the motions after verdict. And one concern I have about the three major contentions is that the materials that were provided to the trial court said that there was a failure to be prepared to examine Bobby Bolin, a failure to call Lynn Allen, and a failure to submit a Schiffer motion. But it does not say factually what would have been learned if Bobby Bolden had been properly prepared to examine. It doesn't say that Mrs. Allen would have said anything favorable to the defendant's case, and it doesn't say any reasonable basis for thinking that there was a document which contained the psychological reports of the two young victims, which is what Schiffer's all about. I mean, to me, they're just conclusory allegations. Where are the facts that are necessary to support a hearing?
The problem that was faced in that situation was in the passage of time trying to obtain some of that. But beyond that, I think they all related to the effectiveness of the trial counsel.
But don't you have to say before you get a hearing that if trial counsel had been effective, he would have brought Mrs. Allen in and she would have said, I was out shopping with her that day. So, I mean, certainly if that's believed, that testimony is critical and should have been brought in. There's nothing that says what she would have said or what she wouldn't have said if she were brought in.
That's true. Mr. Allen had represented that there had been accusations to his wife. And counsel said he had checked them out, trial counsel.
Mm-hmm. Accusations about what?
Which would have had inconsistencies with respect to what happened.
So the girls had told his wife things about the interaction with him that were inconsistent with the stories they told to the police?
And conduct was inconsistent with the fact, their conduct over years in this case was inconsistent with the accusation. And the question, as I saw it, was the investigation of that. I mean, there was a motion for post-judgment inspection, but I had hoped to get into, when that motion would have been heard, the testimony of counsel with respect to these issues. The specifics are difficult sometimes. I mean, you know, people have to be brought in the court.
I understand that, but when I look at whether the trial judge should have held a hearing, I think it's the obligation to give that judge enough information that there is either a question of fact about what the truth was of a particular occurrence, but based on facts, not, you know, you just should have brought in Mrs. Allen. Well, why? What would she have said? I mean, couldn't Mrs. Allen give an affidavit and say, the girls told me this and this and this, and then you could have pointed out, well, they reported something quite inconsistent to the police?
That's true, Your Honor. As I viewed it at that time, it was what she was, in fact, had told counsel, trial counsel, that he said he had checked out. And, you know, I viewed it primarily as what exactly was done. I didn't have...
Is there anything in the record that I could find that would... I mean, you're too general for me. I'm a, like, you know, Sergeant Friday in the old TV shows. I want to know what the facts are. What is it that she was told, and is there someplace in the record where I can go find that?
I can't think of where to refer the court. All I can argue is that in some cases of this kind, when you have a date set, Your Honor, I would, as I saw it, uh-huh. And perhaps I'm wrong, but as I saw it then, a date set where the judge said, okay, someone's going to take the stand here, including the attorney. Mm-hmm. And his investigator, perhaps, and we're going to have a hearing on this. And as you prepare for that hearing, for example, the letter may be determined not to exist, and that issue will fade.
But see, I'm back before the Mochner hearing that you're talking about. I'm looking at whether Bentley was properly applied. And my concern is, did the trial judge have to have that hearing you're talking about? Well, when I look at what I'm used to seeing, it's usually there are facts reported that would cause the judge to be concerned about both sides of the issue. But I don't see any facts if we just look at, you know, a failure to call Mrs. Allen. Well, is there something in the record that would show me what Mrs. Allen would have said that was relevant to the question of Mr. Allen's guilt?
Mrs. Allen was not cooperative, and there was this family related family court matter going on, and as I saw it then, the factual fleshing out of the actual specifics would probably have to take place in court. Ms. Allen would not be signing affidavits. And
but you couldn't even put into an affidavit for the court what she said to her husband or what she said to someone else that you were relying on for the necessity of calling her?
I was not aware of anything further I could have added. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, Bentley, as you indicated, has a couple of prongs, I think, to follow up on earlier question. And it seems to me that the first prong is when a court must hold a hearing. And that is satisfied when the facts alleged, if true, would entitle the defendant to relief. So you're asking here for to be able to show that the counsel was ineffective and that as a result of deficient performance, your client sustained prejudice. Is that what you're going to have to show then under Strickland?
Yes.
Okay. So is it your position that you have alleged facts sufficient in your motion to require the court to hold a hearing in that you have alleged facts which, if true, demonstrate prejudice?
If the facts turn out to be true, then we would establish that, in fact, Mr. Allen had not had a fair trial, that, in fact, that he is entitled to relief.
In your motion, what facts or what part of your motion can I refer to support your assertion that you have alleged facts which, if true, demonstrate prejudice?
If true, what we've alleged would be that counsel, when he waived his opening statement, had no idea what the evidence was going to be, and that's why he waived it. That
now, where in your motion do you say that when he waived it, he had no idea what the evidence was going to be?
I don't believe that's in the motion itself.
Okay. Well, I want to stay because this is kind of this is a paper review. You know, we're dealing with the sufficiency of the pleadings, and your motion is the pleadings. Now, under Nelson, as interpreted and applied in Bentley, there are occasions when the court must hold a hearing. And that is, as I indicated, which if the alleged facts, if true, would entitle you to relief. Then there is another stage when the court may exercise its discretion and have a hearing or not have a hearing. Even if what you've alleged doesn't require a hearing, the court can still hold a hearing.
Yeah,
is it your position that the trial court erred as a matter of law because your motion for post-conviction relief alleges facts which would have mandated the court to hold a hearing? Or is it your position that the court erroneously exercised its discretion because even if you don't have it all here, you still should have held a hearing? Or is it both?
Well, I certainly believe that court erred in its discretion by not having a hearing, and that's primarily where I'm coming from. However, as I understand it, there's also a showing here that there's some serious communication problems, to say the least, and some issues with respect to pretrial motions and investigation that were not addressed, and that they, in a case, especially a case of this kind, rise to such a level that it warrants to say that the first prong is satisfied and there is a basis here for a hearing. And I think the judge erred when he said it doesn't make any difference with, when you're talking this type of a case in particular. Some cases, perhaps, but this type of case, it's my position, I should say, that the opportunity for a false conviction is something that that is of concern. And when you have this kind of a showing, the hearing doesn't have to take that long. You know, a lot of it can be weeded out. We should have at least had a hearing. That's all I'm looking for. I'm not looking for a reversal. I'm looking for a hearing. And what is of great concern to me is the fact that this whole thing is sort of blown off, quite frankly, because a trial attorney says, well, I did it. I've done it all. You know, and that's it. He's not under oath. I mean, I think there's a checks and balances that everyone in this room has to be aware of, and it has an impact on us, and it has to exist just in the trial court with trial lawyers.
The problem, counsel, is that in order to make a judgment about whether to order a hearing, the judge has to look at your motion and determine whether the facts, if true, would entitle your client to relief on an ineffective assistance of counsel theory. And as I understand your motion, you've got three areas that you have alleged that Mr. Teilicki was ineffective on. One is the inadequate preparation to examine Mr. Bolden. Two is the failure to call Lynn Allen. And three is the Shifra issue. But you haven't said, as has been explored by other members of the court, what the facts are that would make a difference such that your client would be entitled to relief on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. You're relying on the hearing to produce those facts instead of pointing out to the court in the motion what they would be. So let's assume that the court, instead of simply denying this outright, would have invoked the Saunders procedure and said, okay, replead, tell me what the facts are that Ms. Allen would testify to such that it would make any difference to the outcome here so that I can evaluate whether, if those were true, you'd be entitled to relief. Tell me, does the letter exist that Mr. Bolden should have been better examined on, and what's in the letter, what facts are in the letter that would have made any difference here? And tell me whether there are any Schiffer-related documents and what they might or might not contain that would make any difference here. What would you have said in response to that opportunity under Saunders if the trial judge had given you that?
What I would have said is that my client has said that there were some statements made by somebody, it was in social services somewhere, that there was a mistake here, that there was an error here, that really this whole matter shouldn't have come forward in his language. That's one thing that John Allen told his attorney. And to find out what reports we're talking about. Then there was the letter and exactly what influence Bobby Bolden may have had on sensitive crimes in issuing this charge, as well as the accusations coming forward to begin with. And then finally, there's, again, just generally, the lack of any preparation. He asked a question and didn't have the answer for sure. See, my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Backus. Mr. Wren.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Christopher Wren. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I appear on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. At the outset, I'd like to tell the court what the state hopes the court will do with this decision. First thing the state hopes, of course, is that the court will affirm the Court of Appeals decision which in turn affirmed the circuit court's denial of the post-conviction motion. The second thing we would like the court to do is, in general, to affirm the existing Nelson-Bentley standards. We think they are correct standards. But at the same time, the third thing we hope you will do is use this opinion as an opportunity to clarify some of those standards in several different areas. And in terms of clarifying those standards, I'd like to suggest sort of three frames of reference that the court could use in helping lawyers, other courts, and if nobody else, perhaps some pro se litigants, understand what it is they need to do when they present a post-conviction motion to the court, particularly in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel. Three frames of reference, I suggest, that can provide some guidance in outlining these standards are the journalism technique of 5W&H, the who, what, when, where, why, and how. This court has used that, has referred to that in other cases. It's actually in Bentley where the court quotes from the Seventh Circuit opinion in United States versus Key. The Key decision refers to the who, what, and when. It doesn't refer to it as a journalism thing, but it goes down through a little explanation about those kinds of things. And in State X. Rel. Evanow, when in talking about what's required for pleading, this court has also specifically referred to the 5W&H. That provides a useful way of thinking about one of the clarifications, which is what you need to do to actually plead a fact as opposed to an opinion or a conclusion of law. Second frame of reference would be the summary judgment technique, which helps distinguish plain old facts from material facts. And I think one of the things that's missed in a lot of these motions, and I think was sort of revealed in the discussion earlier, is what the difference is between a fact and a material fact. Summary judgment focuses on material facts. There are cases that define what a material fact is. And that's what's really at issue, I think, in terms of the pleading standards with these motions. We want the judges, as this court has written and the Court of Appeals has also written, to be able to look at the motion and decide whether there is something there that might affect the outcome in effect. I mean, that's the informal way of saying it. But the only way you can know that is if you've got material facts. It doesn't matter in a case like this, for instance, what time the sun rose. That's a fact, but it's not a material fact to this case. What is a material fact is, in the sense, the letter. Did it exist? What did it say? How would it have affected the outcome? The third frame of reference would be what I would refer to as closing argument, because closing argument, and when combined with summary judgment, is a way of presenting the case itself, aligning the facts with the conclusion that the relief that the party, the moving party, wants the court to reach, a way of explaining how the facts yield the result. In this case, Mr. Backus and his client would like to have a hearing. Well, the principles of summary judgment and closing argument help explain how you bring together the facts with the legal principles to persuade the court that you are entitled to a hearing. The second, another area of clarification would be what it means to have a material fact, how to link the pleaded facts, and also to provide perhaps an explanation, some guidance on the mechanism for getting this in front of the court. The questions were asked about, well, why couldn't we have had an affidavit? That's the kind of mechanism that I think has to be clarified, because certainly the post-conviction motions I see, I'm sure that this court sees, what you're getting are these conclusory allegations, the statement, sort of the broad statement that, well, things went wrong, in effect. What we need to know is how they went wrong, and in order to overcome the loss of the presumption of innocence, whether it's through the plea or through the verdict of guilty, we need something that's going to come back and put that in, give it some seriousness. And to the extent that you can get it in the federal courts, they do it with affidavits. I think that would be a good procedure here. But I think this court needs to give guidance to the trial courts, to the judges, or to the lawyers about what it is that you have to do in this motion as a matter of mechanics to get these things presented to the court. The final thing I hope that you'll clarify, and although this wasn't raised directly, it is a matter of the standard of review and the burden of proof. Interestingly, Wisconsin has not yet, the courts have not yet stated specifically what the burden of proof is on a defendant in terms of proving ineffective assistance of counsel. In the Lukasik case, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, L-U-K-A-S-I-K, The standard is given as clear and convincing evidence, but it's qualified when it says that that's the standard in a case where the attorney is not present to respond. You can sort of tease the clear and convincing standard out of another case that's not cited in either brief, but it's Pierce versus Colwell, which is a Wisconsin case, where it talks about clear and convincing being the standard for proof of a due process violation, which is, in effect, what ineffective assistance of counsel works out to. Several other states have said this explicitly. Cases in Indiana, Arkansas, and Tennessee have specifically said this. It would help clear up this little I guess it's a lock one, or just this little gap in the standard of review and the burden of proof.
But in that regard, are we talking about questions of fact or questions of law?
Excuse me?
Ineffective assistance of counsel claims, when properly done and the motion is granted to conduct a Mockner hearing, involve fact-finding as well as legal conclusions, correct?
Well, ineffective assistance of counsel, I guess, this is what you would call the constitutional fact. It's both a fact as well as the legal conclusion. To me, what happens here is that I think that's what gets people confused, is that terminology. Excuse me?
You want a burden of proof on the defendant in his papers?
Well, that when the court is...
If the facts are true... that it would be clear and convincing evidence that the activity of the lawyer was below standard and prejudicial? I mean, what do you want a burden of proof for?
Well,
we're talking just about papers.
Sure, I understand that. I think the question is whether you can satisfy the Strickland standard based on the allegations you've made.
If true.
If you don't know what that burden is, if true, you don't know exactly whether you should be granting a hearing or not. It's not that the court is concluding that it is clear and convincing, but that if true, it could conceivably satisfy its clear and convincing standard.
Who does it know? The defendant making the motion or the court ruling on the motion?
Who doesn't know the standard or the burden? I think both, because, as I said, what we don't have is a clear statement of that burden in Wisconsin case law yet. The Lukasik case is the closest one. When I cite Lukasik, I actually cite it as a CF because it isn't directly on point. I typically refer to a case out of Indiana called Thompson, which does say that specifically. But it's not critical to this court's decision that it write that into the opinion. But it would be if the court sees it as appropriate, it would be a useful thing just to have that cleared out, that little gap cleared out there.
I don't understand how that – I can understand when you're saying that the court has to hold a hearing if the allegations, if true, would result in the relief requested. But what about when there aren't sufficient – the pleadings aren't that sufficient? How does that burden come into – the discretionary call?
I don't think it does at all.
Okay, I don't think so
not
either.
At all.
I just wanted
no,
to clear
it's,
that up.
It's just a question of if you've got a series of facts here and they look like material facts, if they aren't conclusions or opinions, and the judge says, and they're linked up to the Strickland standards for ineffective assistance, then the question is, well, even if you believe all this stuff, it's not really all. It might not be all that persuasive to a jury or to whoever the fact. If I have to hold a fact-finding hearing, if this is all you've got, maybe a preponderance, but definitely not clear and convincing. I think that's the kind of where the discretion comes into play, and where when the judge is writing the decision about whether to grant or deny the hearing, that the judge needs to know what the burden of proof is going to be at the hearing. In order to have a sense of whether a hearing should be granted, and I would say that you know if a judge has doubt, you know, am I in that arena there? My view is that the judge ought to err on the side of holding the hearing, but that only occurs if you've gone through these other standards, if you've pleaded facts, if you've pleaded material facts, if you've created an issue of fact, if the record doesn't conclusively show that you're not entitled to relief, those kinds of things. The one thing that I think does need some clarification because it's an awkward statement in Nelson, and it's sort of carried through that whole line of cases, is this, is the, are these two criteria. The first criterion is that the defendant is entitled to a hearing if he alleges facts that raise a question or an issue of fact. On the other hand, the defendant is not entitled to a hearing if the record conclusively shows no entitlement to relief. And the question is, what happens if the defendant alleges facts which, if true, would entitle him to a hearing, but the record conclusively refutes those facts? That's the anomaly that we keep confronting here, and I know, again, in writing my brief and talking with my colleagues, we try to write around that because it's a confusing thing. I suggested in my brief that the court that the standard should be, or it should be clarified, that the allegations of fact are in effect might raise a presumption that the record can rebut. And that if the record does rebut it, then those facts don't really raise a question of fact.
I understand your anomaly, but that suggestion would be contrary to the language, not just the same cited language of Nelson since 72 in many cases, but as recently as Bentley, where, again, independent of Nelson, said it is required. So you've got a lot of cases saying it is required rather than this presumption idea you're asserting.
No, I understand. The hearing's required, and then you run into the problem in a case like this where let's assume that the allegation of the missing letter is sufficient in and of itself. What we have is a record with a witness testifying under oath, I never wrote a letter. It seems to me that the mere allegation
Your who, what, where, when, and why take care of that then?
I would like to think so if it's pleaded adequately. For instance, in connection with the letter, the allegation, I think, would have to run along the lines of a letter was written, it was sent to such and such a place, it was sent by Mr. Bolden. I have searched it out and I found a letter and here's the copy attached.
Mm-hmm.
From that, the judge can conclude that, well, maybe the testimony wasn't accurate. But absent something that directly conflicts, you've got a problem.
It seems to me that the who, what, where, when, why goes a long ways to correcting the anomaly of the record conclusively establishes something else because you've already put forth why the who, what, where, when, why.
Right. I think that's correct. I think that by helping everybody understand what it means to plead a fact, how to distinguish a fact from an opinion or a conclusion of law. And I understand that is not an easy thing to do. There are entire law review articles. I'm sure there have been entire law review volumes dedicated to deciding what's a fact and what's an opinion and what's a conclusion of law. But I think that over the course of the Nelson-Bentley line of cases, it's kind of gotten lost somehow. It can be teased out, certainly, but I think it's kind of gotten lost about what it means to plead a fact. And that for me, certainly when I was in journalism class, that first introduction to the 5 W's and H really sort of helped clarify what it was I was going to be trying to do. In effect, that's what we're all trying to do when we do these motions, when we try to advise the court. We're trying to, in effect, tell a story. And the story is the 5 W and H. And when the story is done, we want to tell the court what the meaning of that story is. And the meaning of that story depends on what the legal standard is. In this case, it's the Strickland standards of deficient performance and ensuing prejudice. But everything always flows from what those facts are. And if we don't understand how to explain a fact to a court, how to present a fact in a motion or an affidavit, we continue to run into the question of what it is we're actually deciding. And so that's what, if nothing else, I'm hoping that the court will take some time and try to explain the importance of and how to distinguish a fact from an opinion, and then to clarify that what we're talking about is not just any old fact, but we're talking about material facts along the lines of what we do in summary judgment.
Counsel, in your brief, and you go through the genealogy, which I enjoyed, thank you, you start, of course, with Nelson, and Nelson, that you're citing on page 12 of your brief, indicates a difference between
the approach in post-conviction motions like we had in the cases that you've cited,
right,
which are all post-conviction, and pre-trial motions.
Right.
And so that starts with the Nelson citing to the United States versus Jocelyn case and the rationale for distinguishing between the two, pretrial being much more liberally construed.
Right.
And yet I have concerns that post-Bentley, that Nelson and Bentley have blossomed, not staying in the post-conviction arena, but blossomed into pretrial suppression hearing, blossomed into Shifra, as Justice Rogensack talks about, in terms of getting health care records, and just a variety of other pretrial motions that have been denied hearing based on Bentley-Nelson line of cases. Can you respond to, is that something this Court should address?
I'm not sure whether it needs to address it in this context. Certainly in your opinion in Bentley, you talk about the difference between pretrial and the post-conviction, the post-sentencing kinds of motions.
And that comes right out of Nelson.
Right, yes. And it's a direct line. I mean, I don't think there's any whatever Washington and Tolliver and Saunders say. It's basically a direct line between Nelson and Bentley, and we frequently refer to those standards as the Nelson-Bentley standards, not the Nelson-Washington-Tolliver-Saunders-Bentley standards. It's blossomed, I think, because the notion of ineffective assistance of counsel has blossomed. It's become ineffective assistance of counsel, I think, has sort of become, I don't know, the tofu of post-conviction motion, because you can form it into anything almost. If a Shifra motion should have been filed and counsel didn't do it, it's certainly a pretrial thing, but if it has an impact on the outcome of the trial, it's arguably a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. So I think that the problem, in a sense, is not so much with Nelson and Bentley per se. If there's a problem, it's with the way we construe ineffective assistance of counsel to reach errors pretrial. If ineffective assistance of counsel were solely construed as a trial deficiency, we wouldn't be pulling in things like Shifra motions and so on. I'm not sure you can confine it that way. I'm not here to argue that you can. I don't think that's certainly not something that was briefed. It wasn't okay. Seen as an issue.
It comes to mind because of the exposition that you set forth and emphasizing in that, by way of quoting from Nelson on page 12, the difference between the pretrial and post-trial hearing request. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we're pretrial, we're not necessarily talking about ineffective assistance of counsel, you know.
Right.
So I can appreciate your tofu example, but I don't think for me, now correct me if I'm wrong, for me that doesn't totally respond to my concern, because I don't talk about ineffective assistance of counsel generally in a pretrial context. And I see it being applied to deny motions pretrial.
Well,
motion hearings, rather.
Let me see if I'm understanding what you're asking. Are you concerned about whether there should be a different burden or a different pleading standard for pretrial as opposed to the post-trial motion?
Yeah. My underlying concern is I don't want meritorious motions which should require hearings are not summarily disposed of, because you can do so under a Bentley analogy and then not have to deal with scheduling those hearings because of administrative difficulties. So I'm concerned about Bentley not being abused, because I think it's easy to be abused. As I understand it now, it's being applied to deny hearings in pretrial context, suppression hearing motions, that kind of stuff. And I'm just concerned about denial of a pretrial suppression hearing based on Bentley analysis?
Not having done a trial in a very long time and not having had to deal with a suppression motion at that stage, I don't know how widespread that is. I assume that, you know, at your conferences you hear reports or bar association meetings. My own view is that I agree that Bentley, the Nelson-Bentley standards are appropriate for post-conviction motions. I think the standard is higher than what should be applied in pretrial, and to the extent that it is being imported into these pretrial decisions, I don't think it's an appropriate one. I don't think it's an appropriate standard to be using. At the pretrial stage, you're trying to determine what should come in. And at that point, in order to create the record, it seems to me that you would want to err on the side of more hearings rather than fewer. At the post-conviction stage, when the issues have supposedly been more or less resolved through the jury trial or through the plea, then the standard, it seems to me, the configuration at that point requires a much higher standard, that you don't simply get to come in and say, as you would pretrial, well, or the notice pleading, which is what this Court rejected in Bentley. You don't want notice pleading at the post-trial stage. You want specific facts about why the facts that were found or are certainly inferable from the verdict should not be trusted. And that requires a much higher burden of proof, particularly because, at least in criminal cases, the proof had to be beyond a reasonable doubt. We just don't want people coming in and making open-ended arguments about why we shouldn't trust a unanimous decision beyond a reasonable doubt. So I understand your concern, and I do think that the Nelson-Bentley standards, I've always perceived anyway, as being applicable to the post-conviction, post-sentencing kinds of motions, not to motions that are presented pre-trial or even during trial when you're dealing about evidentiary issues. When it comes to the issue of material fact, again, I think this is something that gets missed a lot. The way, as I recall, I think it's Nelson says, it has to raise an issue of fact. And it's easy to raise an issue of fact, but the question is whether it's a fact that really matters to anything. And that's where the material fact standard comes in, I think, that you can draw on summary judgment procedure for that. You have plenty of cases that define material fact. I mean, one that I pulled out from Johnson versus Cocomore, quote, material facts are those that are of consequence to the merits of the litigation. Not all facts are of consequence to the merits of a litigation. And that's what I think has to be under, that's how Nelson, the Nelson-Bentley standards, sort of have to be clarified, that it's not just an issue of fact, it's an issue of material fact.
Does that go far enough?
Pardon?
I mean, there's a lot of facts that are of consequence to the litigation, but the burden on ineffective assistance of counsel is more than that, isn't it?
Well, to the extent that there is a burden, to the extent there might be a difference in burden, summary judgment, of course, occurs pre-trial. So, and that is a civil standard as well. But the issue of its significance has to be understood in the context of whatever the claim is the person's making. So,
it's got to go beyond being merely of consequence. It's got to
show
a reasonable probability of a different result.
I think that's right. Yes, and certainly in the post-conviction stage where you're trying to overturn findings of fact that have already been made that have led to a consequence.
So you mean to suggest an adaptation of the summary judgment act of consequence terminology to the particular burden that the defendant has to carry in an ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
Yes, that's what I'm suggesting. I'm not suggesting that you just import it whole cloth. As I try to say up front, I'm using these as sort of frames of reference, as analogies, however you want to characterize it, but that they provide a way of thinking about what it is that really has to be in a post-conviction motion pleading. To me, it sort of reduces to the big so what question, that every time a fact gets raised, every time and brought in, the issue for me is so what. What does it mean? Why do I care about this thing? In this case, if we look at the letter, to me, the letter at this point is a big so what. And the reason it's a so what is because the purpose of the letter in the context of this case was to show that Mr. Bolden had been the instigator of these charges. Well, Mr. Bolden, and that the instigation had occurred by contacting the Sensitive Crimes Unit through this letter. What we know is Mr. Bolden did in fact contact the Sensitive Crimes Unit. He admitted it, his wife admitted it, but he contacted them by telephone, not by letter. In this context, the letter doesn't, I look at the letter and I say, so what? The issue that Mr. Talicki was trying to present at trial was Mr. Bolden was the instigator. He instigated it. There's no question about that. So the letter, in effect, is largely irrelevant to the question of whether there was ineffective assistance of counsel. He got in the point that he wanted to get in through the admission of the person that he wanted to admit it. So the material fact is really, to me, is you know, it's just so what. And if you can answer the question when you say so what, well, here's what it means. That's the sort of closing argument, summary judgment kind of thing, where you're linking those facts with the legal conclusion, the outcome, the relief that you want as a result of filing the motion or making the plea to the court. If the court doesn't, I've actually pretty much covered everything that I intended to cover. And unless the court has other questions for me, I'll be perfectly happy to yield back my time.
Thank you, Mr. Wren. Mr. Backus.
Your Honors, I would echo what in part has been stated here. And I think certainly as a trial attorney, primarily what I have seen in the various counties I practice in is motions being liberally granted outside of Milwaukee County. And in Milwaukee County, because of court calendar being routinely denied. And that's a frustrating experience from my perspective. And when you're trying to have a truthful hearing on certain matters. What of concern is the five W's and how they can be applied in all cases. And I think that's something that also needs some consideration. Not every type of case lends itself to that type of analysis, and specifically in this type of a case. And what you need to consider is an attorney strategy. Is it strategy, counsel? Is that why you did this or that or not? You know, how do you find this out? I mean, I've been told that cross-examination generates truth. And if that red flag is flying on a strategy of a trial attorney as to why he did this and why he did that, and in some cases you're not going to be able to get, absent that engine, absent that hearing, you're just not going to be able to nail down that you can say, this is what I'm going to be able to show. I'm going to show this. I'm going to show that. I'm going to show this. This whole process evolves. And I think what I'm looking for, what I saw in this case, was some guidance, as counsel so eloquently asked for, to me and to others I talked to say, What can you show that would show to a trial court that you got a problem here? And there may be a wrongful conviction. There may have been a miscarriage of justice. How do we answer that question? And that's what I do believe we need help on. And I think counsel, I can't say it any better or write it any clearer than he has. And I think that's what we're asking for here, too. And I would respectfully submit that in the case of John Allen, that what I've argued here with respect to how his attorney handled this matter, he deserves a hearing to find out what was this guy thinking of, what was his strategy, why would he only give him the police reports in the bullpen behind as the jury is in the jury assembly area. How does that lend itself to a good attorney-client relationship to defend a case? This animosity perhaps understandable. This whole process could generate things that we can't begin to imagine right now that post-conviction counsel may not be able to nail down with such specificity.
Do you have a backup position, Mr. Backus?
Pardon me?
Do you have a backup position?
A backup decision? I'm not sure I understand.
A backup position, as in if you're not going to grant me a hearing or reverse and remand for a hearing, as in reverse and remand for an opportunity to replead your motion pursuant to whatever clarified standard the court might choose to set in this case?
I apologize. I'm just not catching the point Your Honor's making.
You've asked for an opportunity to have a hearing.
I'm asking for a hearing, yes.
And let's assume that the court, as is suggested by both counsel, uses this case as a vehicle for clarifying a standard, the Bentley standard.
Yes.
And I'm asking if it is perhaps your backup position that you would like an opportunity to replead your motion pursuant to whatever clarified standard that the court may set.
Certainly on behalf of Mr. Allen, if the court finds that that needs to be done, yes, Your Honor, that's what I would be asking. I apologize.
That's okay. I may not have been clear.
But I believe that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Backus. Thank you, Mr. Wren, for discussion of the Bentley-Nelson line of cases. That concludes our hearing on 02-2555-CR State versus Allen. The students will remain here. I will be out momentarily. The students will be joined by other students who are here for the first argument. The court will meet at 2:05 in conference. And we are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.